Welcome to the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast for hormonal mamas who want to reclaim their own natural state of health to thrive and raise healthy kids. I'm Dr. Lisa Weeks, naturopathic doctor in Toronto, Canada. I'm a perimenopausal mama to my toddler named Stuart.
And I'm Dr. Toni Reed. I'm a naturopathic doctor, birth doula, and hypnobirthing educator in Calgary, Alberta. And I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little girl, Frankie. The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not meant to substitute professional medical advice. Always consult with your licensed healthcare provider. Welcome back, everyone, to the Perimenopausal Mamas Podcast. Today, it's Dr. Toni and Dr. Lisa. We are together again. Yay. For a brand new episode.
It's been too long, Toni. I missed you.
I missed you too, Lisa. At least, again, we have, you know, some nice episodes that we're able to, you know, share with people for the second time so that, you know, those of you out there have been listening to both of us. But it's been a while since Lisa and I have been together. So I'm glad this is working out.
Yeah, we're not going to let it go that long again. So we love having guests, but we love chatting together as well.
Absolutely. And today we're going to be talking about a topic that, Lisa and I, we deal with our patients so often. And a lot of people are out there and, you know, you may have different digestive issues, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, gas, abdominal cramps and pains, and you may have gone to see your family doctor and maybe have gone through a whole whack of tests, whether it's blood work and, you know, different scopes, barium swallows, colonoscopies, and everything seems fine. And you're told, oh, you have IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. Well, something that, is really important for people to know that a lot of people don't realize is there's more and more research being done on what is really most possibly the root cause behind irritable bowel syndrome for the most people who have had the diagnosis of IBS, and that's SIBO, which is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. I don't know. I will often have patients come to see me again with, you know, different digestive issues and will think, oh, it must be because of food sensitivities or other things. And not a lot of people have heard of SIBO. I mean, some people have, but definitely in my case, it is something that I'm sharing more and more with patients. And so I think this is a really important topic that we share with everyone else out there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these people really are, you know, can be suffering for a while and they've tried, you know, eliminating foods that they might be sensitive to, whether following an elimination diet, a low FODMAP diet, or through food sensitivity blood tests. They may have been put on a course of proton pump inhibitors. They've had various scopes or imaging done, but they're just still suffering no matter what they do. And, you know, if we don't get to the root cause, which is actually a bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine, so abnormally large numbers of bacteria that may be found in the gut, but they get in really high numbers in the small intestine and they start to cause problems. So they produce a lot of excess gas, these bacteria in the small intestine, and they are fed by carbohydrates and they produce gases that we'll talk about, you know, we can measure through a breath test, but gases like hydrogen, methane, hydrogen sulfide, and irritable bowel syndrome, you know, can be more constipation type, diarrhea type, are alternating. Depending on the types of bacteria and the gases they produce in your gut, that will influence whether you have more constipation, more diarrhea, or alternating between the two. So we don't want those bacteria to be there in high numbers. So there's definitely a way to test and treat. And there's so many reasons why those numbers can get high, why those bacteria can be in excess amounts and causing these problems. And that gas they make interferes with how things move through our bowels. It interferes with what's called our motility or a migrating motor complex. And sometimes it's the chicken or the egg. Something can disrupt how things move through our gut. These bacteria overgrow, produce gas, and that further influences the motility, or it can be the other way around.
Absolutely. And then also, you know, that bacteria can interfere with proper digestion of our food and also the absorption of our nutrients as well. So it's almost like that bacteria is stealing away some of those nutrients from us. And it can be sometimes really frustrating because, I mean, I've had women come to see me where they're really looking at eating healthy, you know, eating lots of vegetables and whole grains and lots of fiber, and that doesn't have them feel great. So it can be frustrating because it's, you know, a lot of people don't realize that it's even like these healthy carbohydrates and fibers that can really feed that bacteria. So again, it can be frustrating. And yeah, a lot of people don't realize that there can be underlying cause for that IBS. And there's been a few different research studies done where definitely over 50%, but even up to 84% of people with IBS actually have been found to have this small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or SIBO. And again, you know, it can be where you are experiencing like those classic symptoms of IBS that you mentioned, Lisa, like having the constipation, having diarrhea, or alternating between two of them, having abdominal bloating, having gas, having pain or cramps. But there can be other symptoms that have been shown to be linked to SIBO as well. Heartburn or reflux, nausea, again, food sensitivities. And food sensitivities can absolutely be increased when you do have this small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. There can be a whole other number of different issues and conditions that are related to SIBO as well. Fatigue, headaches, brain fog. I've definitely had patients where once we've treated SIBO, their brain fog has disappeared, or other patients where they have muscle pain or joint pain. And then once we really get into the treatment for SIBO, that lessens. Of course, you know, like I mentioned, that bacteria will kind of steal our nutrients. So there can be, SIBO can definitely be involved in different malabsorption issues like anemia, or even just chronic low ferritin or iron stores, and even deficiencies in our fat-soluble vitamins, like vitamin D deficiency. And I don't think we really necessarily mentioned SIBO in our vitamin D episode that we did. But again, that can be a key piece of it. There can also definitely be skin issues that are related to SIBO, like eczema or rosacea. I definitely keep that in mind when I have patients that have issues that with the skin that come in, especially if they have digestive issues. And then other inflammatory conditions can be related to SIBO, because definitely there can be a trigger and an increase in inflammation when you have SIBO. So people who may be experiencing inflammatory conditions like pancreatitis, interstitial cystitis, prostatitis. I mean, I know that we won't be experiencing prostatitis, or any of the perimenopausal mamas out there won't, but I will never forget when I had a male patient come to see me, and he was experiencing some issues with his prostate. He was also having some bloating, and so, you know, we even, you know, did a trial of some treatment. His bloating went away, and it was like, oh, wait a minute, there might be some SIBO there. So again, once we took care of the SIBO, that prostatitis went away as well. So something for, you know, us to keep in mind for those men in our lives as well.
Definitely. No, good point. Because anything that affects our gut, right, can infect or contribute to inflammation or problems in the rest of the body, right? Because then at that gut interface, there's things getting in through the intestinal cells into the bloodstream, and our immune system mounts a response and it circulates around the blood and deposits in different areas like the brain, the joints. You can get brain fog, joint pain, deposit in the skin, causing skin rashes. So I commonly see a nausea as a big sign, heartburn and reflux and rosacea, kind of those three. Sometimes, you know, the stools too, obviously can be a big concern, but the, you know, waking up and feeling nauseous, getting reflux no matter what they do, having the rosacea and the brain fog is a big one too. But each person presents differently, and there's definitely a lot of different causes. So if you hear yourself in, you know, one of these causes, definitely talk to your naturopathic doctor, your healthcare provider. We'll get to some testing options. But things that can contribute or cause SIBO, a big one is acute gastroenteritis. So let's say you pick up a bug through travel, through eating some food that is off. So you get the food poisoning symptoms, the stomach flu, so nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, you know, and it may not last that long. You may feel like you've recovered, but then you're like, wait a minute, now I have these symptoms that are, you know, lingering or alternating, and you know something's off. So that definitely can cause SIBO. We know that using proton pump inhibitors, so if you're suffering from, ironically enough, reflux or heartburn, you may be prescribed this. So it may actually progress to SIBO because it may affect the motility as well as just your stomach acid levels that's needed as well for proper gut function. Then you can get, you know, an overgrowth of these organisms that that may actually make your reflux and digestive symptoms worse. Obviously not for every person, because some people do notice a difference using those medications. We've talked about, you know, ideally not using those long-term. We can link to an episode where we talked about that, about reflux and heartburn, but those can be some major causes. If someone's had any sort of surgery, so, you know, I have had some patients where they've had like gastric bypass surgery, or if people have gastrectomy, like, or parts of their digestive system taken out, whether it's from ulcers, cancer, inflammatory bowel disease, that can have, you know, an effect back up the digestive tract. So then there can be this overgrowth in the small intestine as well.
Absolutely. You know, there can be a number of different dysfunctional digestive disorders that can really, especially even with the ileocecal valve, that can interfere with, again, that motility and how those migrating motor complexes move bacteria through the digestive tract, because we have more space for, you know, not only that beneficial good bacteria, but also that kind of neutral commensal bacteria in our large intestine, in our colon. And if there is any reflux coming up from the large intestine to the small intestine, that can be an issue. But also even not having enough stomach acid or pancreatic enzymes or bile flow to really kind of kill off or kind of control the levels of bacteria moving through our digestive tract, that can also be important to kind of look at. Also, when it comes to motility, you know, what can impact that is thyroid function. So if you are having sluggish thyroid function, that can also lead to sluggish digestion, which can, again, be an issue with the motility and can be one of the factors in SIBO. Also, what, you know, something that I've really seen with my patients and especially with looking at, you know, doing training and research around SIBO, is looking at people who have a history of concussions or different head injuries. Because if that's interfering with how the nervous system is orchestrating and signaling for the digestive system to work, then that can be an issue too.
Mm-hmm. And I also think, I wonder too about poor blood sugar regulation, right? And then we know the nerves can be damaged. There might not be proper firing of the nerves to the gut. Yeah, whether there was other types of injuries in the body that may be impinging upon nerves to the digestive system. I think there's so many reasons, and we're just starting to uncover, you know, a majority of them, but I'm sure there's some that will be uncovered as time goes on, because I think it's a fairly new area of research that is getting more and more on medical doctors' doctors, naturopathic doctors' radar. And, you know, people are noticing huge differences if they're being treated for SIBO in terms of, you know, the IBS symptoms, reflux, the other symptoms we talked about, you know, going away, being, you know, put under control. But yeah, it's a process. Sometimes people need more than one round of treatment, which we'll get to. But an interesting feature of SIBO, so a lot of these people that are suffering from the symptoms we went over, well, naturally, most of them know about probiotics, right? So they'll go get like a high potency 50 billion probiotic, maybe with a prebiotic, like the food that feeds the bacteria in our gut, and they take it and they feel worse. They're like, what is happening? Probiotics don't work for me. Well, we know that different probiotics and different strains can aggravate SIBO or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Things like Saccharomyces boulardii, other yeast type bacteria or organisms, I should say, sometimes can help those with SIBO. But sometimes you need to actually do a treatment to get rid of the bacteria before you actually bring in the good bacteria, or you want to make sure you're using ones that are not going to cause any problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And now, and I don't find that that's a hard and fast rule, but it is definitely something that I've always asked people to, is like, especially if, you know, when you have digestive issues, you might tend to reach for a probiotic, especially there are a number of different probiotics that have been studied that really have been shown to help to reduce IBS symptoms. But that's something to really kind of keep in mind. And definitely, you know, something to think about, you know, if you are wondering if you, how do you know if you have SIBO? There are some people who have different IBS symptoms, and it could even just be bloating that has been getting progressively worse, but then may get better after an antibiotic treatment for another infection. You know, I've definitely had patients where they've been having bloating, they get an antibiotic, and maybe even I have them follow up with a really specific garlic extract that has been shown to be really effective for infection, and then their bloating gets better. And then, so, you know, if something like that, you know, happens, then it's definitely something to kind of have that SIBO pop up in your mind as something that you may be experiencing. Again, and I also even mentioned, you know, if you are looking at eating healthier, getting more veggies, getting more fiber, and then you feel worse in terms of bloating and gas, and your body doesn't necessarily adapt to that extra fiber, you know, especially eating veggies like broccoli or fruit like apples, then definitely something to keep in mind would be to look at the possibility of ruling in or ruling out whether you have SIBO with doing testing.
Mm-hmm, because those bacteria will take those carbohydrates and produce those excess levels of gas, as we mentioned. So methane, hydrogen sulfide, and that's how we test for SIBO. The most common test that is used, that's fairly simple to do, it's a home collection, is called a breath test. So basically you fast for a period of time after restricting certain foods with carbohydrates and fiber the day before. And then you do a first morning collection of your breathing into this little tube that's collecting the gas. So that's your baseline gas level. And then you ingest a solution, whether it's lactulose, glucose, depends on the type of test that you're doing. But the lactulose is a non-absorbable sugar that won't get into your bloodstream. It gets into the small intestine. And if those organisms are there, those bacteria are there in excess numbers, they're going to take that lactulose, they're going to use it to make those various gases. So then every 20 minutes, over a period of 3 hours, you're breathing into this little tube and collecting the gas in this little tube as well. And that's what's shipped off to the lab to be analyzed for different levels of those gases that I mentioned. And depending on, you know, how it rises over a period of time and which gases are predominant, that gives us the information that we need to know which organisms are in excess. And then there's different treatments based on which organisms are there. whether it's antibiotics or herbs to help eradicate or get rid of those organisms. So, you know, the tricky part, I think, is the fasting period and the restriction period before. And yes, you're breathing into a little tube, you know, every 20 minutes or so, but it's definitely less invasive than some people recommend the small intestinal aspirate culture, where this is like where you put a long flexible tube via the endoscope down your throat and goes to the small intestine. And this is then a sample of intestinal fluid is taken and tested in the lab. But obviously that is, you know, more invasive. So the breath test is commonly used. But I'm seeing more and more practitioners just do a course of antibiotic or antimicrobial treatment if they're assuming SIBO is there. No test is perfect, right? So the breath test may not always pick up on SIBO. And if you're negative, you potentially still could have it, but there are some good statistics to show it's fairly reliable. But some people are just opting for a course of treatment and then seeing how you respond to that. And that might be another way to assess for SIBO.
Yeah. And again, you know, definitely doing the, you know, getting a culture of that bacteria from your like small intestinal fluids is, you know, gold standard. It's definitely not something that I've ever seen a gastroenterologist offer to people. So it's like, okay, if we really want to see, you know, to what extent this bacteria is there, what gases are being produced, the breath test is the best option we have at this point. And sometimes again, the, you know, people will want to just go right ahead and do treatment, like you mentioned, Lisa. And I don't necessarily have anything against that. It's just a matter of, you know, how are we going to know whether that treatment is really complete, whether we've really taken care of that bacteria, you know, whether it's there or not, because there are other, you know, causes for bloating and other symptoms as well. So, I mean, personally, I really do recommend getting that breath test done to see what's there. And I can completely understand if people just want to, you know, bypass that and go towards testing as well.
Yeah, they'd have to fit in, have the proper criteria, right? So there's certain, you know, points or symptoms they'd have to be having. And, you know, if they've tried other things first, obviously, it's not going to be the first thing you jump into. But let's say you've been suffering for a while, and you've gone through some of those other, you know, you've done the food sensitivity elimination diet, you've done proton pump inhibitors, like, yeah, so I'm not saying go and take it right away. But it's more and more doctors are recommending that if people have been suffering and done these other therapies without success.
Absolutely. And sometimes I'll even have patients first do something as simple as, you know, a little extra digestive support. You know, we've talked about hypochlorohydria before.
I love that word. Yes. You want to tell people what that is again? They might be like, what?
Yeah, that low stomach acid. So especially, you know, when we are on the go a lot, you know, the past couple of years have been stressful for the vast majority of us. And when we're in our sympathetic nervous system response, or fight or flight or freeze, that's where our blood flow isn't helping to support our digestion. It's going to our defense muscles, to our arms and our legs, because our body's kicking into survival mode, life or death. And in that mode, you know, your body doesn't care about digesting your food, because that's not what's going to kill you. It's worried about what's going to kill you. And so being in that stress mode, chronic stress, especially over the long term, that really does shut down our digestion and doesn't have our body produce stomach acid, ideally, to prepare to digest our food. So oftentimes I'll even have people just start with a way to really trigger that extra stomach acid. Sometimes it's apple cider vinegar, or sometimes it's even a HCL challenge like betaine HCL, to really look at, again, is it just that you just need that extra kind of priming of your digestive system to deal with some of these symptoms, whether it's reflux or whether it's bloating or gas or that kind of thing. And sometimes that can be helpful, but if it's not completely helpful, then we have to look at what else is there. And oftentimes then it's about looking at this small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
Definitely. I know we eat in such a rush state. We're on our computers, we're shoving our food down our mouth, maybe in the car. So there's a really good mindful eating raisin exercise. You can do it with a blueberry, but it's a 5-minute exercise where you're actually just looking at, you know, the blueberry or the raisin, smelling it, feeling it in your hands, feeling it in your mouth, you know, feeling what it feels like on your tongue before you actually chew it, and really savoring every moment, because that's how we're supposed to eat. We're supposed to have that feed forward anticipation. We're cooking the food, we're smelling it, our salivary, you know, juices and digestive juices are starting to be released. And then when we eat, ideally we're in a relaxed state. So there's a lot to be said about just, like, you know, running from that bear and then shoving food in our mouth as we're doing it. That's literally what our body thinks is happening. So of course we're going to have a hard time digesting, but obviously with SIBO, it goes deeper than that. But that low stomach acid, you know, if your stomach acid's low, there's more likelihood of organism overgrowth or bad organisms getting into the gut, because the acidity in proper levels kills off the excess organism. So yeah, that apple cider vinegar, I crave vinegar, and I have it before every meal. But so that's some great ways to support digestion. And then you also want to support liver and gallbladder, right? So if you've had your gallbladder removed, you're not going to have, you know, they say your liver picks up the slack, you know, it's going to store the bile. I still see it challenged for a lot of people where digestive symptoms may over time get worse. It might not be right after their gallbladder is removed, but you may need to get some liver gallbladder support, things like N-acetylcysteine, you know, the bitter herbs, dandelion, artichoke, beets, green tea, just to support liver and gallbladder function. That's definitely part of it as well.
Absolutely. You know, I always mention to people, when it comes to, you know, treating and dealing with SIBO, it's not just about killing off that bacteria or reducing those numbers. We don't want to just, you know, take care of that bacteria and then leave your digestive system in the same state that it was in that had that overgrowth start. And that's where absolutely making sure that you're having, you know, more optimal levels of stomach acid, your pancreatic enzymes, your bile production, dealing with any leaky gut that could be there. And again, if you want to dive into more of the topic of leaky gut, way back in episode 8, we talked about leaky gut. Can you believe it was that long ago?
Oh my gosh, time flies.
Time flies when you're having fun and that's talking great. All about all of these different topics. So we'll definitely link to that in the show notes, because we really want to, like Lisa said, give that liver support, give that bile support. One of my favorite bitters is a bitter herb called gentian, which can be really helpful. But, you know, especially after looking at lowering those bacterial levels, really making sure that your digestive system is really functioning ideally, and especially supporting that gut lining with different gut healing nutrients like glutamine or NAG, and even really supporting your different sphincters along the digestive tract, the lower esophageal sphincter, with, you know, something like lemon water or D-limonene can be really helpful.
You said sphincter. I bet you some people are laughing right now.
I don't even think about that when I say sphincter. Again, I just get so stuck in my naturopathic brain.
Oh, I love, like, it.
Of course we're talking about sphincters.
Of course. Yeah. So that valve between the esophagus and the stomach is really key, right? To support. So it doesn't, you know, close off. It closes when it's supposed to. So some of these, yeah, are great, great supports. And even just having a proper stomach acid is really key for that as well.
Absolutely. And then even, like, again, supporting that circulation, supporting the liver, supporting the digestive system overall, you know, a great kind of naturopathic tool can be doing topical castor oil or a castor oil pack. So again, that's can be really helpful for just providing a little bit of soothing of the digestive tract, but even helping to heal up what is not really functioning well and moving well can also be really helpful that way too.
Definitely. And then when we look at what do you do to actually get rid of those bacteria? So definitely the antibiotic that's used a lot, like most of the time actually, is the rifaximin. So this is usually done as a 2-week course. I believe it's 3 times a day that you're taking it. So that's had great clinical outcomes to get rid of those bacteria. Sometimes people may need to do a second course, especially if they're not doing some of these other supports that we talked about. But there's also great herbs that we use. So yeah, really concentrated garlic extract, oregano, berberine, myrrh, thyme, golden seal. Sometimes these are in combination as well. You want to talk to your healthcare provider because you want to pick and choose what's best for you based on your results. But these have really good effects as well. The herbs typically take about 4 weeks of treatment, and you're dosing like a lot of different herbs in the day too, as you know, you are if you're taking the antibiotic. And sometimes we do pair a specific probiotic or nutrients just to give your gut a little bit of healing support, because you know these treatments can be a little rough on the digestive tract, but we're using them with good intention and good purpose because you know they can get rid of those organisms. So the antibiotics typically take about a 2-week course. The herbal treatment usually takes about a month course. You see how you are after. Some people will retest through the breath test. If they're still feeling kind of crappy, maybe they would do a different course of action, a different antimicrobial herb, for example, or redo the antibiotic and then retest or see how they are at that point.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people will ask me, well, why would I even think about doing a prescription antibiotic if we know that typically prescription antibiotics can really throw off the balance of that good bacteria along our digestive tract? And with the rifaximin, again, there's been a lot of really positive research around it. And it's a different type of prescription antibiotic because it doesn't get, doesn't impact the body systemically. It really stays in the gut and has been really shown to not throw off those levels of beneficial bacteria as much as a typical antibiotic would, and not have the same kind of impact on liver, kidneys, and the rest of the body as well. And definitely, you know, something else I keep in mind, not only in terms of those really specific oregano and garlic extracts, is even, you know, pepper, enteric coated peppermint oil has been really shown to really be helpful in terms of symptoms, as well as helping to treat as well. So that's always, you know, it's nice to be able to have a number of different agents to use, whether it's that prescription or whether it's even just the herbs, or again, following up the prescription antibiotic with herbs is to really, you know, I find everyone feels a bit or gets a bit of a different effect from some of these herbs. It's not one size fits all. It's not, you know, each person's going to respond to them to the same level. It is about, you know, really, can we figure out what agents really gets that bacteria taken care of, and let's really maybe repeat more of the doses of that combination to really get the best effect in the shortest period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good to note for sure. And also we need to recognize that bacteria can hide out in what's called biofilm. So this is kind of like a protective layer. So then the antibiotics or the antimicrobial herbs aren't, you know, contacting those bacteria directly. So sometimes you need to incorporate what's called a biofilm disruptor. So this helps to break up that mucilaginous kind of barrier. And there's several different ways to do that. N-acetylcysteine, NAC is one that is commonly used. Things like, let me just pull up the list here. I'm having a brain break. Black cumin, alpha lipoic acid. So sometimes that needs to be paired with the course of treatment for you to get maximal effect from the antibiotics or the antimicrobial herbs as well. So that's definitely an important piece and included in a lot of the treatment protocols for patients.
Absolutely, especially depending on how long that bacteria has been around. It does have that ability to put that really protective coating around. I don't know who coined this. I'm not sure if it was a colleague of mine, I wish I could remember so that I could again credit them again. But I think of it and I describe it like, you know, like Harry Potter's invisibility cloak.
Oh, I love it.
You know, we, you know, if that invisibility cloak is around that bacteria, we won't be able to find it to take care of that bacteria properly. So we need to, in a sense, use these biofilm disruptors to kind of punch holes in there so that whatever agents that we use, whether it's a prescription antibiotic or herbal antibiotic, can actually get to that bacteria and disrupt its activity and help to kill it off a little bit too. So
that's a great analogy. I love it. So I'm
it's a great visual if you have seen the Harry Potter movies or have read the Harry Potter books. So
yeah, definitely. And the biofilms apply to bacteria in other areas of the body too. So that's why it can be hard to treat, you know, sinus infections or different bacterial infections if there is that biofilm. So that's, you know, needs to be addressed in other bacterial infections in different areas of the body as well.
Absolutely. Another treatment option that I don't find that I recommend very often, but sometimes is needed, or sometimes is more preferred by some people, is actually doing an elemental diet. And that's actually a liquid diet where you are taking in really, again, the essential nutrients that we need in the form of a liquid for at least 2 weeks, sometimes longer. And that really, because you're not getting these more of the specific carbohydrates that feed that bacteria, it works to starve and kill off that bacteria to a certain level. So I have seen a few patients do really well on an empty elemental diet, but again, it can be a bit rough to go through. So it's not something that I necessarily recommend to a lot of people. Especially when we're doing something like the prescription antibiotics or even the herbs, we actually really want that bacteria to be active. So it's really actually is important to kind of feed that bacteria, not be on something like a low FODMAP diet or a SIBO type, anti-SIBO type diet. We want people to be actually eating the carbohydrates and that actually feed that bacteria while we're giving those antibacterial agents, so that that bacteria is like, you know, not hibernating or hiding, but it's actually like out kind of partying in your digestive system so that it's easier to get at and kill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. So sometimes people may reduce some of those foods, but depending on symptoms, right? If they feel really horrible, but you don't want to eliminate them completely, and there may be different times and places to avoid those. But yeah, you definitely want to give the organisms what they need so they're there. And then when you give the herbs, it's killing them off. So yeah, it's complicated, but yeah, it's an interesting approach. That's for sure. It's kind of counterintuitive, but you know, technically, I guess you could starve some organisms. Eventually they'll die, but you know, for them to get low enough numbers is probably not likely. So you want to feed them so they get high in numbers, and then you kill them off with the antimicrobial herbs or antibiotic.
Absolutely. And like I said, we don't just want to kill off that bacteria and then that's that. We want to do some digestive support. And that's where really making sure that we're giving the proper support for your motility, for those migrating motor complexes along the digestive tract. Their activity is really key. So sometimes, again, after kind of that eradication phase, doing a recovery phase with doing some agents that really help to support that motility or act as like a prokinetic. There's different prescription medications that can help with that, a very low dose medication called prucalopride, or other more natural agents like ginger or 5-HTP, acetyl L-carnitine, again, the bitter herbs. There's a combination called iberogast that's really helpful for, again, getting that motility going, really supporting your digestive activity. But also what's really key is to, again, pay attention to not just what you're eating, but when you're eating. And what's really key to allow for those migrating motor complexes to really work properly is to actually have a real break between eating. So making sure that you're eating or leaving at least 3 hours between meals. And so, especially for those of you out there who are more grazers, or, you know, there's this idea that I remember growing up with that, you know, it's better to eat, you know, multiple small meals in a day. That it not only isn't necessarily great for our blood sugar and our insulin response, but it's also not great for our migrating motor complexes. And that's where it can really interfere with how our intestinal tract moves things down, and not only can kind of set us up as a possible risk factor for SIBO, but can interfere with us really recovering from that bacterial overgrowth.
For sure. Because yeah, if you think about it, we're really supposed to be, you know, hunters and gatherers. And we, you know, search for our food, we eat a lot, and then we go a long period without food until we find more food. We don't want to just constantly be digesting, you know, if we're expecting things to move through on a regular basis, that's not going to happen. So getting those periods of fasting between meals is really key. And then I like the analogy of, you know, yes, you could kill off the flies on like, a garbage dump, you could just kill them. But if the garbage dump, like the garbage is still on the ground, it's going to attract new flies again. So we want to look at, it's kind of called our miasm. Like, why are those flies there in the first place? Why are those bacteria there? Yeah, you could temporarily get rid of them, but if you don't deal with these other components, it's just going to come back, unfortunately.
Absolutely. So now, did we cover everything in terms of SIBO, Lisa? Did we miss anything?
I think we did a really good, this is a great, yeah, intro episode. And, you know, we dive deep as well, deeper than I thought for people that might already know a little bit about it. But there's, yeah, I think it's such a fascinating topic, but I think we left people with enough things to think about. Yeah.
There you go. So again, and we also, again, have those links to our previous digestive episodes, the episode 8 on leaky gut. We also did talk more about constipation, both in adults and kids, in episode 63. So you can check those out if you want to do an even deeper dive than what we already did today.
Perfect. So check those out for sure. So yeah, let's move to the next part of the podcast. So Tony, I want to hear your super mom moment. I'm sure there's been so many over the last few months, but can you pick out one?
Yes, I can definitely pick out one, because, you know, what I was really getting annoyed in the evening after Frankie would have a bath, she would just like leave her clothes on the bathroom floor. And her daddy wouldn't put them away, and they would just, and she wouldn't put them away. They would just be there. And I was really starting to kind of resent it and thinking, oh, like I would always be putting them away for her. And I didn't want to resent that. It's, again, that's not something that's really great for us as moms, to just feel like we're always having to clean up after our kids and do things for our kids. So I chose, instead of just continuing to put them away and being frustrated and resentful about it, I actually just realized I don't have to do it. I can just instead get her to put her clothes away. So it's really become actually part of our routine in the evening is, you know, after a bath and, you know, reading a story and then going to, when she, after she brushes her teeth, then it's a matter of, okay, time to take, pick up your clothes and put them in her laundry bag. And she didn't do it. She didn't complain about it. She'll do it herself. She feels really proud about doing it. And I don't know why I didn't necessarily think of that right away and think of it sooner, but I'm so glad that that's just part of our routine now. So that she, again, she learns that she has to clean up after herself, and I'm not going to always do it for her.
I love it. Yeah. It's hard to know what age, right, to start giving them more of those responsibilities, but sometimes we can be surprised. They feel empowered and they like helping out. Not all the time, but
yeah. I wish it was all the time, but no, it's not all the time.
But that's great. I love it. Yeah. You're definitely a super mom, Tony.
Aw, thanks, Lisa. Now I know you're an awesome mom, Lisa. I like, you know, you have so many different super mom moments from previous episodes, but do you have a mama mess up that you can share with us this week?
I do. I was trying to like let the routine go, right, of like bedtime and wake time. And I think it's okay to do sometimes, but we were at the cottage for two nights this past weekend with, you know, our Stuart's cousins who are close in age to him. So they were up extra late. Stuart was the one who slept in the longest. He slept till like 8 or 9 o'clock. The other boys were up at like 6:30 or 7, more of their normal time, but we didn't wake him up because we're like, oh, he's tired. tired. He needs it. And he was fine on Saturday. But then yesterday on the way home, he also fell asleep a few hours after, you know, leaving. So it was still before lunch. And I was like, oh, this is going to be bad. And he hadn't eaten for a while. So by time it came to nighttime last night, it was hard to get him down. And then he woke up 6 times in the night and he was just wide awake. Like he was singing. He came into our room for, you know, I'm hungry. So he actually went downstairs and had a snack at 3 a.m. And then he was, I'm cold. I'm thirsty. I lost my stuffy. So there were all these reasons. He fell asleep for like an hour between 4:30 and 5:30. And then I just got up with him at 5:30. Luckily I'm an early riser, but I obviously didn't get as much sleep as I normally would. But I was like, oh, I guess we pushed it a little too much. We were trying to keep him awake in the car, but yeah, it wasn't a good scene. So I know we don't have to be super rigid, but I think maybe, you know, wake him up before 9.
That might be something to keep in mind. Oh, Lisa, that sounds rough last night.
Okay. Yep.
Thank goodness you're an early riser. And I mean, you're sounding like you're with it and have it together today. So
that's right. Yeah. It's still like anything is better than those, you know, nights of breastfeeding and pumping every few hours. So honestly, anything after that seems easy. It's been, you know, obviously a while since I've had to do that, but I'm kind of adjusted to not sleeping. So
goodness. And well, at least lesson learned so that this doesn't have to happen too often.
Yeah. Being a perimenopausal mom, I've been having a few sleep issues lately. So this wasn't as bad as some of the nights I've had due to my hormones, but we could talk about that another time.
For sure. And then Lisa, what's your mama must have?
Well, since we're talking about digestive support, I love apple cider vinegar. As I mentioned, I have the like unpasteurized with the mother apple cider vinegar. And I just like, honestly, the lazy way is I put a bit of water in my mouth, put some apple cider vinegar on a spoon, shoot it down. I do it before each meal. And if I've gone away and not brought some, I just feel like my digestion's not working as well. I even feel like I have a bit of rosaceous. I feel like my skin gets even more red. Like I just don't feel as good. So I really enjoy doing that before every meal. And then I'm loving, you know, lemon and lime zest in my water. I love, yeah, just adding that in even to salads and coleslaw, but that can really, you know, lemon and lime in general, anything kind of sour, bitter herbs like arugula, that can really help digestion too. So I'm just loving all of those digestive supports. And Tony, what's your mama must have?
Well, now, especially since we have been dealing with many viruses this year, my mama must have is definitely the wet sock treatment. I know that I've definitely talked about it before, and I don't think it ever gets old because just some people still haven't heard about it. It's a really fantastic, really kind of old school, traditional naturopathic cure for really helping to support the immune system. So typically it's used like first sign of a cold or a viral infection, and where you actually like wet a thin pair of cotton socks so that's damp but not dripping wet. And when you go to bed, you put them on your feet, but you make sure that your feet are warm. You don't put wet socks on cold feet. That's not a good idea. So, you know, a hot foot bath or like warm slippers or warm socks or slippers beforehand, but you put them on your feet when you go to bed and then you cover them with a thick pair of cotton or wool socks over top. It feels strange. It feels weird, but you just go with it and you get all bundled up, go to sleep. While you're sleeping, your feet will warm and dry the socks. So, you know, sometimes in the middle of the night, I'll even like take the socks off because my feet are too hot. But while that whole activity is happening of the feet warming and drying the socks, you're really like stimulating your circulation, you're stimulating your immune system, and it can really help to draw out any congestion, you know, from your sinuses, your nose as well. So I love to do that as kind of a first sign preventative. And even, you know, with dealing with a number of different viruses and really helping with recovery, I like using that hydrotherapy. And it's even something that I've started to do more frequently and doing it more nightly. You know, there have been times when I've done it, you know, for a month in a row, you know, even before Christmas or something like that, you know, because I don't want to get sick. But this is where I feel like, especially the way this year has gone, I'm going to be doing wet socks more often than not throughout the summer even.
Nice. That's a great one. Yeah, I go through phases too. I haven't done it for a while, but I used to do it all the time. So definitely I'm going to have that intention going into the fall. And if, you know, Stuart comes down with something, which, you know, is inevitable, then I'm going to start to do some treatments before bed again, and even for him as well. So thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, for sure. No problem. So let's talk a little bit, remind everyone what we're up to. I have another hypnobirthing session for expecting parents looking to really support their confidence and really tap into that instincts in terms of really supporting what the birthing body and our babies do together, and really decreasing fear and anxiety around labor and birth. So you can join me by going to hypnobirthingcalgary.com/register to find out more about that. And Lisa, you have an amazing new meetup group.
Yeah, so it's called Wild Women Adventures Toronto. So I just want to get out and have fun, push myself, try new things, get out in nature. So if that sounds like you and you're in the greater Toronto area, just search on Meetup Wild Women Adventures Toronto. We're going to do a sunrise or sunset stand-up paddleboard, treetop trekking, and we have a new moon workshop coming up for July 13th. So check us out. And then if you want to get on the wait list for my next Wild Collective group, go to wildcollectivetoronto.com and get on the wait list. I'm going to launch a group most likely in the fall.
Excellent. Now, thanks everyone for joining us today. Again, you can find our show notes at perimenopausalmamas.com. You can connect with us on Facebook and Instagram. We'd love for you to subscribe, leave us a review and a 5-star rating if you enjoyed this episode. And you can also support us by visiting our Patreon page. Please tell your perimenopausal mamas friends about us too. So stay safe and healthy, everyone.
Bye. Until next time.